welcome to this week's Data Protection Made Easy podcast with Phil Brining, Dave Holmes and the gang. We had an interesting one today, Dave, last one before the end of the year. We were meant to be talking about the kind of top challenges that faced our data protection community during the year. What kind of things came up, and was an interesting discussion?
It certainly was an interesting discussion. I think one of the top challenges was staying on topic, because as you know, we tend to go off on other areas. But we certainly looked at some of the top challenges that we've had through our support desk. We kicked around some of those and kind of contrasted that with the ICOs publicising breaches and breach information that you'd helpfully kind of put into a quick pivot table and displayed on screen. So anybody who's listening in, Miles, will be able to hopefully make sure they're available in due course. But it's looking at some of the top areas that we've had and the kind of consider those in light of those that the ICO are reporting. And interestingly, to see things like SARS up there, wasn't it? Both with ourselves and complaints and bits and pieces via the ICO.
It was, and I'm just thinking, is that surprising that SARS are there as an issue that, you know, we're struggling with as a community? I mean, they've been around for a long, long time, haven't they?
SARS will probably be more led from individuals complaining, whereas the SARS with ourselves are clients kind of saying we need some help with them, that kind of thing. But they have been around for a while, but there's certainly been spikes, haven't they, with SARS. There was certainly a spike and an increase in the number of SARS being submitted under the GDPR when the cost fee was removed. But I'm wondering whether individuals are still using them, thinking that there's an avenue to compensation, shall we say, or something down those lines. Or some perceived benefit in using a SAR process and then complaining when they don't actually get the information that they're after.
Maybe. Data protection impact assessments, again, an area that we see a lot of. A lot of it is people wanted reassurance, isn't it, that, you know, I've done this. What do you think? You know, is it good enough? You know, does it articulate the processing arrangements adequately? So that again is an area where it seems that. But not so much people lack confidence, but potentially want reassurance about their decisions.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's some maybe have a kind of a bit of a confidence issue, because some of the ones that you look at, you're going, oh, it's fine. And they are just purely looking for that kind of, can you confirm this is the case? Like with breaches, can you confirm this is a breach or it isn't? Or can you confirm whether we need to report or not? I certainly had one this morning from a client asking whether I could confirm whether it's a notifiable instance or not. And I said it wasn't. And they thanked me, said, well, that aligned with their thoughts. So just like they wanted some kind of confirmation of that.
Yeah, but it's natural, isn't it? I mean, I come to you, don't I, some to say, Dave, am I thinking this through correctly? And, you know, other people, you know, that's one of the benefits of being in a fairly large team of, you know, of people who've got the right degree of training, isn't it? So if I've got an issue, I'm thinking, am I thinking this through correctly? I'll come to see you and say, would you just sense check this for me? And, you know, you'll do the same with other members of the team. So it by nature, because it's so, you know, sometimes so grey, the area of the law, that, you know, you do need, I think, second opinions.
For sure.
Sense
for
check
sure.
what you're thinking.
Well, sometimes...
Anyway, we're going to go off. We're not careful. Do another hour.
I was going to just find on that. I sometimes find as well, sometimes you either get in that much challenge or you do a bit of overthinking and then you thought you were sure what the answer was and you're starting to convince yourself otherwise, either through your own thought process or through challenge from others. It's just having that sounding board to kind of go, am I in the right area with this? That kind of thing can often be very useful.
Yeah, yeah. So if we're not careful, we'll end up spending another hour talking about the hour. So we will stop rambling. We'll say thank you very much to everyone who's been listening to these podcasts over the course of the year. Thank you very much for doing that. We enjoy doing it, but we only do it because people ask us to, you know, talk about things. Miles, you've done an absolutely sterling job. The visitor numbers have grown dramatically over the year. What were they at the start of the year? And what are they now? Is it a threefold increase?
Yeah, I think it's had a threefold increase over the year. I think we've gained over 500 subscribers in the last year, and the listeners have gone from 3,000 last year to 10,000 this year. So really, really good to see the community growing year on year.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Well done, you. So I'm going to say thank you very much, Miles. Thank you very much, Dave, for your contributions today. And thank you very much to everyone for participating. I hope you enjoy it. If you don't, let us know. If there's things you want us to talk about, let us know. We're happy to do research and spark a discussion about anything that's in our field of work. Anything further to add, Dave, before we sign off?
Well, absolutely. Not just if you want us to talk about, to add it. If you'd like to join in, if you'd like to unmute, if you'd like to be a guest speaker, do get in touch with producer Miles, and we'll certainly go through that process with you.
Excellent. Right. Well, without further ado, have a happy Christmas when it comes round, and we will see you in the new year, we hope.
All the best. Happy New Year. Take care for now.
Well, what have you been up to this week, Dave? Have you been busy?
Lots, actually. I was making a list and I was checking it twice. just I'll get a festive element in there. I've done quite a bit this week.
That went
actually.
Over everyone's, mine included.
I've brought data protection to life for individuals when I was delivering board training. I've went through data protection training and what boards should be thinking about, and the information governance, the ICO's accountability framework. So I've been looking through that. I've had meetings around about rectifying what in essence could be classed as ropey ropers. So how do we put them into a new format? What's the process? What's the action plan? How do we go through that process? I've been involved in a couple of activities with a couple of clients for the monitoring element of the DPO's role. So it's not the reactive stuff. This is the monitoring element, the framework that we go through, that we've set. So I've been going through some of those elements. I've been involved with SAR processes with a client, and in particularly how we can refine searches. So it's not the processes in a managed structure to make sure we're all doing it consistently in the same way. This was, well, how do we find the data and how do we search for the data, and can we add different tools or different bits and pieces in there to help refine the searches, such as whether the system that you're looking at could facilitate the use of Boolean logic, that kind of thing. I've certainly been looking a little bit more at when is a SAR not a SAR. So, for example, is it an information request because the individual's dead and somebody's wanting access to deceased records, that kind of thing. Training and talking around different styles of training with a client, and whether they want to run their own internal version of Pop on the Podcast series. So 20-minute snapshot fireside chats around particular DP topics that people can listen to it whilst they're waiting for the trains to unstrike, that they've got something to listen to on a cold platform somewhere, that kind of thing. So
wow,
quite a lot
going
on this week.
Like being busy. Yeah. You've been very busy. I've been totally engrossed in a PCIDSS assessment for a customer, which has been quite interesting. Actually, I've done two this week, or bits of two. So it's quite good in a way, in order to be able to help people by finding things that aren't right. So found quite a few points that weren't right. Minor stuff like version control of documents, then some major things like or antivirus software just not configured to run, not mm-hmm. being configured to run for 4 months, which is, again, quite a vulnerability, isn't it? I went to inspect two data centers this week, which is always good. One of them, but both in Manchester, actually. One was, it's an old Bank of England building in Manchester. It goes 15 stories down.
Wow.
So the data center is on like two stories down, and it's an old bank vault. I mean, literally with the bank door, 15-ton bank door. It's been quite a fascinating place. But anyway, they'd had a major outage. I went on Monday. They'd had a major power failure on Saturday, and their generators hadn't kicked in. So the whole data center had come crashing down, which was not good. So our customer, who's a payment facilitator, their payment platform was offline for 5 or 6 hours. So nobody could transact on it, which again was a major problem for them. So when we got there on Monday, all hell was let loose. There was contractors milling around everywhere. There were doors were all wedged open, which obviously shouldn't have been wedged open. A lot of systems had been spiked with power surges when they came back up again. So a lot of the cameras weren't working. The history of CCTV footage covering the data center had been wiped out. So it wasn't a good day to go and inspect them, to be honest, but it is what it is. So I've been completely engrossed in that all week, which has been Yeah, it's been interesting, been good fun. I've had Kenne with me, our new cybersecurity consultant, which has been excellent. She's made some really good observation contributions when we were there yesterday, looking at you know, what it's like with the PCI stuff. You've got to get absolutely into the detail. Yeah, which scripts have you got running, and what protocols, what drivers have you got running on this server? Let's have a look. Why is that one running? Where's your business certification? Oh, it's really detailed stuff. Anyway, that's what we've been doing this week, and it's been incredibly intense, if I'm being honest.
And was there any great changes to any of that? Because let's not forget, PCI version 4 is out. So was any of that the kind of the standard stuff that's transited through, or some of that looking at changes?
No, it's entirely this assessment is entirely against version 3.2.1, which is the current version. Version 4, you know, at some point next year, we'll probably be assessing this against that standard, or maybe the year after. But I mean, you know, these things aren't static. So this client, we've done 4 or 5 assessments for, and they keep changing. They don't keep changing. They out of necessity have to change bits of their infrastructure. And then it's like everything, isn't it? The job of keeping all the paperwork up to date with the reality is a challenge. So, you know, as I say, version control wrong. We've got to inspect the data center racks, and there were some devices in there that weren't on the network diagram. And you know, it's an administrative overhead to, you know, keep the documentation up to date. So there were things that were different. You know, I found that some new tables in the data center, because they've been doing some new stuff for MasterCard. So new tables with that to inspect what was in them. So yeah, interesting, but nothing new for the version 4 PCI DSS on this particular assessment, no.
Well, okay. I remember the other week I went to visit a client. I got a temporary ID pass in order to walk around the organisation. I might have mentioned it on one of the other sessions recently, and as part of a security walk around, I thought, I wonder what this pass can actually give me access to. And it was giving me access to everything. Even went into the server room, had a nosy around that. Went into the room next door to the server room, had a nosy around that. And it certainly ruffled a few feathers. And I said, I was only highlighting an issue. I haven't done it. I didn't unplug anything. Yeah. Don't panic. But it's,
I did the same, Dave. I was, you know, went on the second data center for a different client, also in Manchester, but in a different part of Manchester. I was issued with a pass, which I couldn't figure out how to work. I didn't realise that there was a swipe and a PIN code to put in. So I went back to get it checked, and I don't know what they did. But then I tried every door in the place, and I could get through every door in the building to other people's data centres. And I don't think I should have been permitted to do that. I needed to get into data centre, data hall 1, and I could get into data hall 3 and 2 and some of the side rooms as well. So it was all good fun, you know, getting out there, digging around and...
Interesting, yeah. I mean, I think in this occasion with myself, kind of the stars aligned, I think, and it was just one of those things. And you go, it's just unfortunate on the day that I checked that it happened, but just highlight the fact that there's maybe control measures around. Because we're saying there's certainly some individuals may need access to everything. If you get somebody to come into work on the server, they maybe need a staff pass, that kind of thing. So I get it.
Of course, yeah.
And that kind of thing, but it's just randomly handed out. I thought those kind of passes would have to come with like a big block of cement, so you know the person who's carrying it or something or other.
Yeah. The data centers are quite secure anyway. To get into them, you know, you need a PIN code. There's armored gates, and you know, they're really, and this bank vault one is well, it's in an old bank vault which was used to store gold bullion, so it's really physically secure, and lots of processes, you know, lots of hoops to jump through before you get there. So I'm not saying that the whole thing's you know, like a colander, but you know, again, role-based access control, what's my role? I'm doing an assessment. In fact, the second data center got thrown out of, to be honest, because we weren't, the client hadn't asked the correct permissions for us to inspect the data center's systems. So we could inspect the rack of the client, but then they wouldn't open up their CCTV systems or visitor management systems or access control systems for us to audit. So another trip to Manchester on the cards.
So when you go around, I know it's kind of diverting off the topic slightly, but when you go through things like that, do you have to kind of leave your mobile phone in an area? Or are you able to still carry your phone in your pocket?
No, not on these. And of course, one of the things we do is take a lot of photographs of the evidence. Again, I'm always a little bit, you know, should we be doing this? But that's the way it's done. You've got to compare everything in the racks. There was 5 racks in the second data center, full of equipment. We've got to compare all the serial numbers with what's on the inventory to check it's all correct, and then check it against the network diagram, check it's all correct. So, yeah, you're either standing there writing it all down or dictating it, or we just take pictures.
Okay. I was just interested. I just wondered whether you walk around taking pictures of stuff once you're inside and that kind of thing, or whether they go, well, you can come and audit, but you can't take any kind of photographic equipment with
you. No, it's not like passport control. No, they don't stop that. I've never had that. stopped before. I think Tom had. He went on to some military establishments and some other ones. But he again made a every effort to try and escape the person that he was being chaproned by, and it go off digging around in the rest of the building. Tom was a bit of a sword for that.
That makes a great idea. You should try and film it and have a version of PCI Mission Impossible, that kind of thing. Starring Phil Brining.
Anyway, enough of that. That was this week, wasn't it? We're nearly over. We've got our Christmas party this afternoon as well, which will be good fun. So what have you seen? Have you seen anything interesting in the news? I mean, the new EU-US data privacy framework, the new Privacy Shield or Safe Harbour, has been published. I had a quick scan of it this morning. It's quite interesting, actually. I don't know if you've had a chance to have a look through it.
Yeah, I'm assuming all the normal kind of bits are in there that we discussed previously about setting up kind of like a data protection courts or some kind of avenue to raise complaints through that kind of thing once your information
is in the US, there's seven different avenues. There seems to be a lot more commitment, you know, restrictions on governmental organisations and, you know, hoops for them to jump through, justifications, etc., which are in there. There's seven methods of raising a complaint, including with national DPOs, data protection authorities, and US authorities. So it looks like it's got much more substance than any of the previous schemes, which is good. It's all still self-assessment, self-certification, but then there seems to be a self-certification, then a verification step where you have to submit all your paperwork, your policies, procedures, and an annual assessment, you know, attestation of compliance to submit. And there's a requirement for Privacy Shield or Privacy Framework organizations to maintain records to be able to demonstrate compliance. Again, there's some good stuff in there, actually. Quite long, and I had a very quick scan of it this morning. But it looks pretty good, actually.
And I think there's a UK version around. In the UK version following that, the EU.
I'm not sure, because this, of course, it's a good point, though. I've circled it in red on my notes. This is the EU-US Privacy Framework, not the UK, because we're now not longer part of the
I thought there was something in the background from the UK trying to kind of ride on the back of it all in order to facilitate it and support it, but I thought there probably is. Well, I've often found interesting when you read international data transfer agreements and bits and pieces, when they're looking at kind of supplementary measures, is the fact that as an organisation, we'll tell you if we get approached by somebody trying to access the data under FISA, that kind of thing, unless we're prohibited to do so by law. And you think, well, I'd have thought if the intelligence services were snooping, you're prohibited from telling anybody. But it's a nice little statement. Anyway, nice little statement.
I think there's a request for a link to this, so I'll put it in there. Whilst you're talking, I can't multitask. I will do... Sure. If I can figure out how the chat works.
The other thing that I found interesting, moving away from the EU standard contractual clauses, did you come across the article that the ICO are now publishing names of organisations suffering data breaches?
Sorry, say that again. I wasn't concentrating in the chat. Sorry.
That the ICO are now publishing names of organisations suffering data breaches.
Oh, I did. Yeah. I was going to come on to that, yes.
Because it was interesting, because the article kind of highlights that, well, unless there's a municipality notice, that kind of thing. Previously, the ICO would say, well, actually, it's confidential. We're not necessarily going to go out and change that approach. But the ICO's reason for publishing three sets, it's going to publish one or three data sets, which is self-reported breaches, data breaches, and cyber investigations. And I'll pop a link in the chat shortly for you to have a look at, but their reason is that it's a drive to be more open and transparent.
Yeah, it's good, because I mean, there's actually quite a lot on that site that you're going to put the link into, and I went and downloaded some of the reports this morning to have a quick look at it, because what we're talking about is challenges, etc. So from the ICO's quarter four 2022 complaints, they had 11,220 complaints. This is the sectoral split of the complaints, which is quite, again, interesting. This is the it's a spreadsheet, this, so I'd say go and get it, put it in the pivot table, mash it around, and you know, just have a look at it. It's quite interesting stuff. And these are the types of complaints. I don't know how they catalog stuff and categorize things, because there is potentially some overlap in here. Mm-hmm. But you know, the biggest issue that, again, complaints about, which is probably no surprise, is subject access requests. That's probably from data subjects there. You know, I'm still waiting for my subject to action request from the Ministry of Defence or whoever's got that massive backlog. But again, you know, provide a copy of the personal data same type of thing into Article 15. So, you know, that's accounting for the vast majority of the complaints that they had this quarter. If you look at, again, there's sectors on sectors. Now, this is complaints by organisations, so they're all named. Fortunately, I've checked, we're not on the list, Dave, which is good. So these are the organisations that have had the ranked by most number of complaints. Again, you have a look at that because that's quite interesting. And then you can go into the kind of subsector. So I had a look at the housing sector or housing associations, 110 complaints. Again, the list actually names who these complaints are about.
They do, yeah.
But again, same type of things, you know, in the same types of proportions, right of access, providing a copy of the data. So this is still, you know, something that is causing issues with consumers and data subjects, isn't it? And I have to say, in thinking about what we're doing today, I know we're going to dive in about all over the place. Come back, Ollie, to guide us. I had a look at the types of cases that are being raised in our, but with our support desk, and also the types of issues we've raised doing our audits this year. Which I'll come on to in a second. So hopefully this is going to eventually make some degree of sense. So the support desk cases since 2018 have risen quite considerably. Two and a half thousand nearly. We've not finished the year yet. And this year, the topics we get asked about by our customers, again, the same types of things, you know, other rights requests, subject action requests, still process the contracts. Now, the nature of the work we're doing in the cases often is advisory about a rights request, isn't it? You know, we've had this request, yeah. What should we do with it? Can we apply this exemption, et cetera, et cetera. And often though with processes, it's can you have a look at this contract? Can you check out the due diligence? What do you think of this? And so that's the types of things that we get in the support desk. Same with data sharing. The majority of those, I think from memory, is probably can you write a data sharing agreement for me, please, or can you check this one?
I'll review it.
That we've got. You know, we talked about some of those cases the other week. You know, with the business and enterprise grant data sharing agreement. That's one that we've looked at a few times. Policies and procedures generally it seems to be: can you write this? Can you check that? Will you have a review of that? The breaches is very often is we've done this has happened an incident, you know, is it a breach, is it reportable, DPA, I'm not gonna go through all these DPAs, often it's we've done this DPA, what do you think? Which is usually not a great deal, because then you know they're often not that useful.
Details
in that they don't
missing,
exactly, yeah. So I compared year by year what types of things, and again rights is still up there, accountability was up there last year, it's gone down a little bit this year. So that's an interesting, I thought, maybe a view of the types of things that come into us from our clients. Again, it's not a representative sample, nor is this. So the issue, the audits we've done this year, done 26 audits, formal audits this year, and these are the results of just 10 of them where we found non-compliances, non-comps, and part compliances. Then we've got, you know, kind of larger compliant and then compliant as two measures on above those. But again, the things that are coming through this year have been no surprise, data retention, not having done data protection impact assessments or not having a management system for it. People without ROPA still, a lot of issues around processes, still having a part of the compliance system, like I've got a register. This is what happened to one audit I did a few weeks ago. We've got a register of processes, but we haven't got contracts with them yet. Okay, fine. Well, yeah. great for knowing who you got on the register of processes, but now you've got to go and check the contracts with them.
Yeah, the ones I come across with the processes is where if it's run through procurement, it's normally all right, but procurement didn't kick in until 10, 15 grand, for example, and it's all the bits underneath that are generally the problematic areas.
Yeah. So I dived off down several tangents from your news report of the ICO's list, but it's worth having a look at because it's.
I thought it was fascinating.
But these are the
types
of things that are coming through as issues.
So do you think those issues are respective what other individuals are struggling with? Do you think it's Do you think it's highlighting a wider issue, for example? Do you think, because there's issues around ROPAs and breaches and DPIAs and that kind of thing, it doesn't really identify of itself, whether there's issues internally with the culture and whether people are bought into doing this kind of thing. Yeah, we might be assessing the DPIA, but are they done early enough? Are individuals assessing risks that are presented by the processing activities? Are they given any effect to privacy by design and by default? So at the very early stages of a concept or a new processing activity that you're running through the by design, by default element, and that kind of thing. And so it's really, really useful to see. But I'm just wondering whether it's whether it's possibly consequences of something maybe a little bit bigger behind it.
It's a good question, and I don't know. I'd have to think about it. But we're seeing, I think probably, I mean, the ICO's figures, statistics are driven by complaints. Yeah, so that's you probably individuals complaining about controllers and/or processes, And you wouldn't expect to see in there, you know, oh, I'm not sure this controller's got all their processes documented properly. And yeah, it's bound to be right, isn't it? It's bound to be, you know, these people have done this bad thing and, you know, it's infringing my rights. What we see in our support desk and our audits is probably the types of challenges, admittedly on a micro scale, you know, we're only looking at, you know, a handful of organizations of a particular type who are probably more motivated to get this right than a lot of other organizations. So it's not a representative sample, but these are the, you know, we go in and do an audit and we find non-compliance, we find gaps, find areas for improvement. So that is a true reflection of the types of things that, you know, we as provisional practitioners are struggling with. And what I was interested in, privacy by design is one area we've picked up on more this year. We've kind of let it go a bit in the past, thinking, you know, nobody's really got their head around what that means in practice, so we're not going to be really stringent on it. But this year we've been saying, you know, you really need to be able to demonstrate that you've got privacy baked into your process and your systems. And I noted that one of the data protection authorities on the continent had fined an organization on the basis of privacy by design non-compliance. And I can't remember if it was the Poles or the Belgians, but I will find it. So I think that will come through more, you know. You know, you're culpable if you haven't baked privacy into your systems and processes. So I don't know whether we're seeing a representative sample or not. And I'd be very interested to see what the listeners here, the participants here, you know, would say are the top challenges that they see, you know, don't necessarily face themselves, but the types of things that they see in other organizations. Maybe there's they feel them themselves, you know, the challenges that they, you know, that they have. I was listening back on the, remember the Stuart Barker,
yes, with the ISO 27000. Yeah.
So I listened back over that this morning, just because that was one of the most listened to this year. And he was basically saying, as you probably recall, I wasn't on it, but you were, that, you know, implementing, you know, writing the policies deck, he said, takes a couple of days. Implementing it takes, you know, a lifetime. You know, you're changing behavior, changing culture. And it's the same with this, isn't it? You know, we've got a new job for a, you know, big organization to draft up a privacy framework. Oh, it's a doddle, absolute doddle. But implementing it is going to be rock hard because it's a big organization. Yeah.
And on the implementation side of things and checking that it's been embedded properly and people are adhering to it, from the implementation stage, what would be the time lapse, would you say, before you start thinking about auditing it?
Well, I think, you know, ideally you'd have kind of a year's worth of records to show it's bedded in. I mean, some of the routines that you might perform are probably annual reviews, maybe some quarterly reviews. So there's no point in doing an assessment when, it depends on the environment. You know, if you've said, well, these high risk areas, we're going to have a control process, a monitoring process in place monthly, then fine. You know, after 2 or 3 months, you can go and check if they're in place.
Yeah.
But if it's an annual policy review, then there's no point, is it, until you've had a chance to see if it's bedded in or not.
No, for sure. Because some of these things take time to embed, don't they? Even if it's like a stance within a policy, because the requirements are also not just to have you got something that meets the law, but do you meet your own policies and that kind of thing. So when you're reading the policies, have they got anything in there that might particularly onerous or might put a particular responsibility on somebody or require a particular course of action to be taken? And it's looking at those bits as well. It's not just have you got a policy, has it been reviewed, is it within your review cycle, does it kind of cover what we expect it to cover? It's, well, are you fundamentally doing what you say you're going to do?
Yeah,
and that's and that's the bit that takes a bit to embed.
Yeah, and that's a great point, though, isn't it? And we often find where you've bought people have bought boilerplate, you know, compliance packs from the people that sell them, and they've just kind of said, "Well, that's our policy then." You know, that's that is our policy on this and our procedure on that. And you go and you look at it, well, it just doesn't bear any resemblance to what actually happens in reality. So there's a you know, the big job, if you're buying a templated pack like that, and we obviously sell our own templates, is to make sure that they are, you know, tailored to suit your own environment. But you're right, you know, there's two things, I think. One is, are the procedures and policies, you know, written in a way that will encourage compliance with the requirements? And does the organization fulfill them? Now, if you've got a policy that's significantly raising the bar above the minimum requirement, so, you know, if you say in our OPAs we're going to keep hold of, you know, for instance, lawful basis for processing, which isn't an Article 30 requirement, if you say that's a central place to keep them, our policy is to keep them there, and they're not there, well, to me, that's a non-compliance.
Sure.
With your own policy, you know, not necessarily with the GDPR, Article 30, but with your own policies. I think Brenda raises a fantastic point, because this is something that comes back time and time again, and it's one of my real hobby horses.
I'd be interested, you know, to ask
definition.
I'd be interested whether that's tied to SARS, because you identified on the SARS is quite up the top of the list, and understanding SARS and queries and questions with SARS, and whether Brenda's question there in relation to there's still problems for people considering what is personal data, whether the two are linked, trying to understand what is personal data, then, oh my God, I've got this SAR on my desk, that kind of thing. Would you like to unmute and join us, Brenda?
You don't have to.
No pressure. No pressure. We'll continue anyway. But I think it's a great question.
But it could well be. It could well be, couldn't it? So, you know, in the SAR Bureau, we were constantly looking at loads of documents, and, you know, I mean, we looked at one the other day, didn't we, for a local authority. It was all social work data. And we said, you need to supply us with a list of all who these people are that are named in these 400 or 500 pages. And they said, well, we don't know. Well, how on earth do you expect us to know whether they should be, you know, redacted, or if it's reasonable to disclose them, you know, under the, you know, reasonableness for disclosure provisions in the Data Protection Act?
Sure. And then when you look at it,
our software, I'll pull out all the names, you know.
Well, absolutely. But personal data is more than just names, isn't it? There's a software, a bit of kit or something that might just put out names. If it comes back to just kind of focusing on Brenda's point of, well, what is personal data? Well, names are only part of it. It could be a particular phrase or comment about an individual that would be sufficient to identify them.
Well, exactly. I meant to move on to that point to say that when then the narrative goes on and he said this about, you know, who's he, you know, because that is a comment about somebody made by somebody. And equally, you know, we're looking at other types of records that are the personal data that have only got a unique identifier on them rather than any obvious way of, naming a specific individual. But I think that is, again, one of the big areas. You look at the definition of personal data, you think, actually, the way it's phrased, it's like, I'm not sure I understand that. And then when you think hard about it, you think, actually, that's really, really vague, isn't it? And particularly as some information may become personal data later, depending upon the intent and the usage of it. It's not as easy as it should be.
No, for sure. So I think it's a great question. It's one we kick around all the time, isn't it? Sometimes when we've got a few minutes just to kind of have moot points about bits and pieces. I think it's a really fascinating topic to kind of go, well, what is personal data in that sense? But going away from the obvious, I'm not just looking necessarily naming addresses, but one thing that I often ask when I'm delivering training to teams is whether they consider, I'm not necessarily going to give them the answer immediately, but whether they consider opinions about somebody, whether that would be personal data. And if it is personal data, then whose personal data is it? So I think that's a great topic to kick around.
Yeah. There is actually, Rebecca, there's some quite good guidance that the EDPB, European Data Protection Board, produced, and the ICO has produced. We'll dig it out and submit it. I mean, it's about 30 pages long, but I like the European Data Protection Board guidance because it goes into quite a structured argument, and it gives lots of examples. And for instance, it gives an example of a car mechanic, you know, fixes your car and writes notes up. You know, those notes relate to the car mechanic, and therefore, in the eyes of the European Data Protection Board, are personal data relating to the car mechanic. To all intents and purposes, it's just records about a car. But, you know, again, it's just interesting to read their interpretation. And the ICO's guidance is a cracker, isn't it, on photographs, when they're saying, you know, if if you take a photograph, but the intention is not to photograph or capture anything specific about the people in the photograph, then it's not personal data. But if you then start to reuse that to make assumptions about the people in the photograph, then it does become personal data. And the example is of a bank robbery, and so people looking in a window of a bank, somebody takes a photograph of it, not personal data, because the intention is to provide a picture of the bank. But if there's a bank robber and the police want to look at that picture to see if the bank robber is running past, then it becomes personal data because the use of that personal data has got a change of purpose. Easy to say, you know, hard to work with, particularly if you're looking at records in a SAR.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. And you've got to do a case by case because we don't like blanket approaches either. And sometimes what we see, and I've certainly seen some clients take the approach that if it's got third-party details in it, then we'll redact it regardless, even if it's a letter from the data subject who's making the requests, identifying somebody that they've got an issue with and going, no, it's third-party data, we've got to take that out. You're kind of thinking, but it's come from the data subject. How much sense would it make to remove it if it's actually come from the person who's asking for their own data?
Yeah. I'm just going to look for this European Data Protection Board guide on the internet. I know what it is in our library because we've just been using it in the DPO training, but I will have to find it on the EDPB website. Hey, I tell you what, I got invited to go down to London in January to talk to the ICO. It's like a call for people who want some input on their website. And you know how much I love their website. So I really hope I get selected to go down and help them to talk through their website. Anyway, I'm looking on the European Data Protection Board's website for this thing. So what else have you seen then, David, in like either in the news or as issues? I mean, I noticed that Meta had been fined. Meta had been fined for infringement of Article 25, which of course is your data protection by default by design. That was the basis of the fine, wasn't it? You're not familiar with it. That was the bit that was interesting. Yeah, the Irish Data Protection Regulator has fined Meta £265 million for infringement of Article 25. Basically what they're saying in there is that there's no smoke without fire after a breach, and the controller is usually culpable to some degree, by not having privacy by design and by default baked into their processes. Again, I think that will become a feature going forward.
Well, I think it will, and it's how do you give effect to privacy by design or data protection by default and by design by default? So how do you actually give effect to that? Because it doesn't kind of say you've got to do this, it just says you've got to kind of think about it from the very outset. So how do you bring that to life and that kind of stuff?
I would say you have to be able to demonstrate it. Yeah.
For sure, But you might use, but the point is you might possibly consider using a DPIA for that process, but a lot of the DPIAs that I've been involved with previously are always generated far too late into the process for it to actually be any useful or any useful representation of privacy by design or data protection by design and by default.
Yes, no, I agree with you. No, the Polish regulator fined a company for not having done due diligence on a processor. They'd find a controller for engaging a processor about concluding a data processing agreement in writing without verifying whether the processor provided sufficient guarantees for implementation. Again, that's Poland, that's Europe, that's another world away.
Yeah, still quite useful. The other thing that I was looking at, I was thinking, what might come up in 2023? Is there anything that we maybe need to keep our eyes on for 2023, this kind of thing? Because we're really at the end of kind of bringing 2022 to a close, or it will be by partway next week when everybody starts things about going off on holiday with the Christmas and the festive period coming up. But we've got the Digital Protection and Digital Information Bill, wasn't it? This is what's meant to be reforming the data protection law. And I thought, I wonder if anything's moved on that. Will that possibly reignite itself into 2023? That kind of thing. But I haven't really got any further than what we already know. It got kind of stopped or delayed or paused at its second reading in September. There may well be some form of consultation into 2023 if it moves, and it may possibly progress by 2024. But that leads you to thinking it's on the doorstep of an election, isn't it? And would they actually have parliamentary time to start pursuing that any further? So I was hoping to kind of bring some good news on that one and with other things to watch, but it's paused. It's not had its second reading yet.
No, I read that it had been put on hold and may come back on the agenda 23 or 24.
Yeah. But so, and this is a point, 2024, if they're talking about a general election in 2024, you're talking parliamentary time before they start all the election process, don't they? So you've got only a period of time in which laws can be debated, and it's whether this one will get pushed through or whether it'll get sidelined in favour of trying to retain power or obtain power on, depending which party you represent.
Yeah, I mean, there's some other stuff going through. I mean, we talked the other week about the Network and Information Systems Regulation, which was obviously part of the Network Information Systems Directive, because the Europeans have now got NIS-D2, and apparently the government is now working toward putting in place a revision to the NSI regulations, the NIS regulations. And the only thing, there's quite a lot of broadening out of the coverage of that, but I think managed service providers will get caught under this new revision provision. So that'll be quite a lot of organisations providing information security or technology services, you know, infrastructure service, whatever, will now, subject to all the thresholds and everything else, you know, potentially get caught by the Network Information Systems Regulations, which will be, again, new for them, new breach reporting procedures and new requirements that they'll have to step through if they are caught by that. So that's definitely going, well, I think that's definitely going through. And I was reading about something else,
The other thing I was looking at was the online safety bill. That might go through in 2023. It's got its third reading towards the end of 2022, which won't be long. And then looking at possible royal assent in 2023, and that's aimed at companies that offer services for user-generated content and online communication. So you're looking at things like social media search engines, hosting providers, that kind of thing. So there's a bit in there that's coming through, and the requirements within that is to remove illegal content, so very similar to the EU's Digital Services Act, to remove material that basically breaches their own terms of service and providing a choice over content that is seen, that kind of thing. So that should be coming in 2023, as well as some laws that might be on the horizon.
Yeah, I noticed that there was the Product Security and Telecommunications Infrastructure Act enacted, I think, last week. That is basically Internet of Things, you know, connected devices. I don't know if it'll affect anybody here, but distributors or manufacturers of those types of devices. So that's a new law in that area. There's quite a lot of, change. I mean, it's one of the things we like about working in the sector, but that's quite hard, is the amount of change that's going on.
Yeah, it's just trying to keep on top of it, though, isn't it? There's so much change and so much bits and pieces that are tweaking bits. It's just trying to, how do we keep on top of it all? But we do. We try our best.
Yeah.
We're trying to bring them to you through the podcast series. So if anybody sees any interesting bits of law, or I'm not quite sure if it affects you or not, or think it's going to have an impact on the sector that you're working in, please do fire them across. We may have seen it, but you never know. You may be the first one to find it, and kind of firing it over to us be useful, and we can use these forums to read them and to raise queries within them.
I mean, one would have thought that international data transfers is going to be an issue for next year because of the looming deadline for the phasing out of the old arrangements in the EU. But then, you know, we've got this whole new regime, haven't we, to implement and repaper our contracts at some point. So that's definitely going to, I would have thought, be on the horizon. I mean, it's amazing, you know, on our orders, as it showed that slide earlier, you know, there's still a lot of international transfers, you know, because obviously transfer to Ireland now is an international transfer, and it still needs, you know, properly documenting in the right way, despite it being, you know, provided for under adequacy.
It's interesting. Do you think organisations have got a handle on where the data is actually transferred to? Do you think organisations are still kind of thinking we're UK based, we're only in the UK, we've got providers there, any UK companies, it must be in the UK, without necessarily considering online services or cloud providers and actually trying to follow the trail through to go, and yeah, but which computer is it sat on? Where is it? Which country is it in? That kind of thing.
I think people possibly don't have such a good handle on it. But I'll tell you what was interesting when I was, again, flicking through the Data Protection Digital Information Bill, is that, you know, there's quite a few changes, I think fairly minor changes, but one of the changes to Article 30 requirements, isn't it? And instead of documenting international transfers, it basically seems to say you need to just say where your data is. That seems to be how it's phrased. I'm not sure if I've got that act, actually. Oh, yeah, I've got it on my computer still. So that takes, I think that's a slightly different approach, you know, where's your data, rather than, you know, a lot cataloguing the transfers.
That'd be a good
game. Yeah, where the personal data are.
Takes Article 30. Sorry. I was going to say it'd be a good game, wouldn't it, for International Data Protection Days? Where's my data anyway? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it does. It does. It says, you know, take out Article 30, put in Article 30A. Each controller must maintain appropriate records processing to A, where the personal data is, including information about any personal data outside of the United Kingdom. That would be the new requirement in Europa. So slight tweak, but you know,
It would be a slight tweak and a slight interpretation for companies that are only caught by the UK GDPR. If you're based in the UK and you've still got EU GDPR to comply with, you're probably going to comply with a higher standard anyway, aren't you?
Yeah.
I would have thought so too.
So right, what else have you been up to or think is, you know, on the horizon for next year?
Well, I kind of hinted at it with the International Data Protection Day, International Data Privacy Day, and depending which side of the fence it's on, because that comes up in January 2023,
doesn't it?
Yeah. So we should really be starting to think about, well, what we're doing within our organisations to raise awareness of it and to talk about training matters or to talk about issues that the organisation is facing and how do we deliver and how do we get those messages across, start the year with the on the right foot, that kind of thing, make a bit of a fanfare about it, a bit of a song and dance, but try and get some key messages across as well. And I think, yeah, it's maybe not exciting things as what's legally changed within the law, but what are we doing to kind of promote the data to try and really start the year with a good focus on DP and that kind of thing.
What do you think we should do this year for International Data Protection Day?
I think we should have the GDPR radio series, Data Protection Made Easy, as a road trip.
Right. Okay, that sounds a good approach. I think that's a great idea.
I think instead of audiences coming to us, we should go to the audience. How's that for a...
Right. That's radical. I think...
even Rob Andrew supports it. Andrew anyway, says they've got a DP fest. There you go.
A DP fest. That sounds a good thing. WP29. So I'm just typing, still looking for this opinion that I want to share on the guy on the thing and here. I'm running out of time rapidly.
And then Mark says it'd be like the Radio 1 roadshows, that kind of thing. Data Protection People roadshow. I think that'd be a great idea. I think for me, it kind of challenges for next year and some things that some organisations maybe need to think about, because we do see some good work in some good areas of compliance and that kind of thing. But I think to me, some of the bits that could help with a bit of focus, it's some of the areas that I often talk about when I'm talking to board members and ARC and people like that, is looking at internal culture. And it's all right saying, have you got a positive culture for data protection or not, and how do you demonstrate it, and how do you change culture towards that, that kind of thing, and looking at all your internal structures in order to ensure that we've got a consistent approach. If we're asking people to do things, how do we make sure it's done in a consistent way? How do we make sure that we've got control measures around that, kind of little fences in that sense? And how do we keep people within the fence and allow them to operate within that kind of framework? And I think if we get the culture right and there's an appropriate structure, then that will hopefully find a bit of easing of a bit of pressures on the DPO and the compliance teams. It should possibly make, I might be wrong, I'm happy to be open to challenge on this, but if we get it right from the very outset, it should make the role a little bit easier for the DPO and for those in those roles. And then they can start looking at some of the really, really interesting parts, like I've set some of my clients on with, when you're looking at KPIs, for example. And this is going to sound rather off, but sometimes when you sat there and you're talking to board and they're asking your opinions on, well, we've had a KPI in the last quarter, we've had 15 DSARs, what do you think? And I know this is a kind of a general soapbox issue that I've had on previous podcasts, but what I think about 15 DSARs is generally, so what? What does that mean from a performance indicator? It doesn't mean all 15 were delivered within the statutory timescale, or five of them fell outside of the statutory timescales, or three of them needed extending because of complexity, or because we didn't get our act together, or we were late because it was languishing around in an inbox and somebody didn't do anything with it. When you're looking at a performance indicator, what performance would 15 tell you? just on its own with nothing else around it. And then I started saying, well, can we not, for the next report, can we not start bringing some of this thing to life? Can we not start looking at, out of those 15, what's the root cause, just using SARS here, what's the root cause for the SARS? Can we kind of break that down? And a high percentage of the subject access requests are all disrepair claims, that kind of thing. You know what I mean? So then you can start really giving it some detail and start really getting some value out of the figures that are reported in that sense. And if we're getting a high number of disrepair claims through SARS, and this is an issue, and I know it's slightly touching on something we spoke about last week or the week before about despair with disrepair claims, that kind of thing. How many people are mixing SARS and disrepair claims and bits and pieces, and is it being addressed in the wrong way, and is that having an impact on the KPIs, or at least the volume figure that you're reporting? And it's so that client's really taking it to board and kind of really or taking it on board, not to board, taking it on board, and now we're really producing some really good figures for looking at from a KPI reporting point. And that kind of
thing. I think, yeah, I mean, my perception is in general that there is, I think, generally progress in terms of culture on, you know, acceptance that GDPR is here to stay and that it's something we should be doing. And you know, I go into an organization, I'm surprised at how good they are, actually, if I'm being honest. You know, the 4 or 5 years ago, I mean, but actually going back 15 years ago, it was like disaster zone, you know. But now I think that, you know, you go into small companies and small organizations and, you know, they know about it and they're trying to do their best with it and they're trying to embrace it. And you go to bigger organizations and they're structured, you know, well for it. We've done some audits this year where we've amazingly, you know, had very, very, very few areas we've had to pick holes in, which is great. You know, it's good. I mean, my general feeling is that, you know, I might come on here and moan about it, but in general, I think that there's been significant progress over the last couple of years. And I don't think it's driven by, you know, what the ICO is doing. I think it's just driven by, you know, people wanting to do better, maybe boards, maybe supply chains. You know, I think those types of factors seem to be, you know, making things improve. And again, it might be.
I would agree from the supply chain. I've certainly seen it in the supply chain where organizations are being pushed for information, otherwise they're losing business. And I've certainly spoken to some clients that were in that position. So certainly with the supply chains. In that sense, I've certainly seen some insurance asking for certain information in order for insurance renewals, that kind of thing. So it's interesting that you get some development from those areas, but I often see, and I've certainly seen in other areas as well, that you've got something, but it's not really being developed properly. It's not really being taken to the next step. It's not really maintained, that kind of thing. So it doesn't look like with some that whether it's actually progressed very far other than just like the old light switch, but we've got it to a point and we've got something and that'll do. And the kind of the maintenance element of it, are you showing it's a maintained document? And it's kept under review, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we've got a competition going on for who handles the most SARS. I just feel sorry for you having to deal with that many SARS.
Well, there you go.
Yes, indeed. So, what are you doing next week, Dave? You still working or are you off?
No, I'm around all of next week. So I've got some client work to catch up on. I've got some retention bits to investigate with some of the clients. I've got a little bit of monitoring just to finish and return back to them. I've got a couple of cases that have been allocated to me through our ticketing system that I need to get my head around and provide a response to. So that's coming up for me next week as we kind of tailor off into the festive period.
Mm-hmm. Are you working over the period for Christmas, New Year?
Thursday, Friday. So the Monday, Tuesday is bank holiday for everybody, isn't it? So it's
So
the Monday, Tuesday is bank holiday. Wednesday, I've got a day's leave, and then Thursday, Friday, I'll be back in the office.
And we got some new people joining us in the new year, haven't we? Is that true? I hear a rumour. I hear a rumour.
It is a rumour. But it's a positive rumour. So it's we should have some new consultants joining us to ease some of the pressures, ease some of the workloads, that kind of thing. So that should be good.
Yeah, so Mark's right. You'll be able to have a day's leave when these new people start, Dave. Until then, it's down to the grindstone.
For sure. It's the only day I get, Mark, to be fair.
Yes.
Joking aside.
And you should be grateful for it. Well, I've got to rattle up this PCI report next week. That's my main focus. And then I'm just going to try and get back on top of some of the cases as well, just see what's being going on in the cases.
Yeah, no, I've got to do, hopefully, I'm hoping to try and get on top of bits and pieces towards the end of the week, and then I can start looking at some of the management stuff I need to kind of bring back into life and get ready for the kickoff in the new year.
I don't know if you talked about this a few weeks ago, but I saw it, it's been sat on my desktop for a while, an article about a Chinese security firm advertising ethnicity recognition technology in their CCTV system. I don't know if you've seen it and talked about it in one of the previous sessions. I think it's been up there for some months, so Ollie might have picked up on it.
Ollie might. It seems something I wouldn't want to go near, to be fair. It sounds fraught with difficulties. But it's, I've not come across it.
Right, Hikvision apparently it's called. And I saw that DAC Beechcroft had done a review of the types of breaches that they'd handled. Again, that was quite interesting. So of their like 211 breaches that they handled, quite a good law firm handling breaches. In fact, they dealt with one of the breaches that one of our clients.
Yeah, we were closely with that one, yeah.
Yeah, 75% had malicious causes. You know, they said it's slightly up from last year. 59% of those were ransomware related, so it's still there, still a threat. 31% email compromises. So that if anyone's interested in that, that's just again a very small sample, of a particular type of organization, probably, but quite interesting to see where those threats have come from.
Some reports weren't indicating that still the biggest threat is kind of fire phishing emails, that kind of thing for Cyber Elements. Was that one out towards the October, November time, I think it was it? I'm not saying the only way it's in, but the biggest threat still to organizations is through phishing attack. It's where most of them come through, that kind of thing. We certainly see them from time to time, don't we? Some dodgy emails.
I think I've had about three this morning, but you know how efficient I am at looking at my emails. By the time that I look at my emails, they've all been rumbled. But I think I've had three this week. They just look really dodgy, so I just ignore them. Well, I don't have to delete them, but I mean, I think it's easy to get taken in by them, especially if you're rushing and you're busy.
For sure. And that's what they're playing on, isn't it? Unfortunately, it's a numbers game, and they're trying to find somebody who's got a lot on, the busy, the mind's elsewhere, and they inadvertently click thinking it's important or does something or other. And then they've got you.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Now, I was also interested that the French CNIL, or the rapporteur to the CNIL, is suggesting Apple should be fined €6 million for tracking without consent. Apparently, again, I think you know more about this than I do, that Apple stopped their app suppliers from using location data and other data for tracking people, but actually carried on using it themselves. Anyway, this is something that the CNIL has got hold of and is now, quite upset about. I remember you talking about that before.
I had a catch up with Ollie. I think he was more all over it than I was at that point. But it looked like they were trying to, unless I'm wrong, and I apologise, maybe wrong, but whether they're trying to do all the clever marketing stuff and the tracking stuff through cookies, but it had to be kind of facilitated through the Apple platform in order to give them kind of control over it in that kind of sense. And they had to make sure that apps that were on there, the Apple kind of platform, had awareness and transparency of bits and pieces, that kind of thing. Still cookies and similar technologies, aren't they? They're still swimming around and they're still causing organizations difficulties to get their head around. Although under the new data protection, under the data protection reforms, they're looking at easing it slightly, aren't they? Looking at easing some of the measures around cookies, whether that actually goes through or not, but they're certainly trying to make them a bit simpler, aren't they? I think they've got this kind of cookie fatigue, as if that was ever going to be a thing. Who's ever going to get tired of eating cookies? That was there. Whether it makes it through Parliament, that was there as a kind of a measure to reduce the burden of cookie banners. I think it was not necessarily being transparent about the cookies, but it's just the banners, I think, wasn't it? If I'm right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Gary Stein, he had a scam yesterday saying he'd spent over £1,500 at Asda. I mean, you can do that in Lidl because you have to just go the middle aisle, don't you? Or I'll have one of those, plasma cutter, television, car, washing machine. There's just all sorts in there, isn't there? I do like Lidl. I'm a fan of Lidl. Anyway, we've got 5 minutes left, Dave. So we're not quite out of time yet. So else have we
got? Other challenges from 2022 that I found. Try not to set everybody off. Retention. Has anybody actually found retention done well?
Now that's a big, big area. Don't get me on retention. I mean, that's common on everything. We get raised in the support desk and on audits. It's a simple thing to look at. It's an impossible. I think it's impossible to do retention as it should be. I think
there's two elements.
I just don't think
it?
Systems aren't right for it.
Because there's two elements. We're not just looking at when are you going to delete it after you finish using it, after all the requirements have gone, but whether you should actually be pseudonymizing some of it when you don't need it in an identifiable format. So the retention element of are you retaining it in an identifiable format, not necessarily have you got rid of it because you no longer need it.
Yeah, sorry, I was distracted by mince pies. Apologies. momentary lapse of concentration. Yeah, exactly. You know, some systems are quite good. You know, your more structured database systems, you could program. And where I was doing this PCI work this week, you know, their routines when they're capturing data, they strip out, because you have to strip out some of the digits of a credit card number, and they store it as a kind of first six, last four. You know, that's what you're allowed to do, or all you're allowed to do. Well, you can store it, but then you've got to encrypt it if you're storing the whole thing. And then if they're taking names and addresses, then they use an algorithm to hash them. We talked about hashing before, mm-hmm. haven't we? So,
salting.
Yeah, when I was looking in their code, checking out their code, I found that they used a static hash to hash them, and then they rehashed them with the static hash hashed inside of the value. So that was quite interesting getting into the detail of that.
Do you know if they use a second different algorithm, or do they use the same algorithm for the second hash?
Same one. Yeah, same one. Yeah, so they use SHA 512 plus this fixed salt, which is in the code, and then the result of that gets rehashed using the same SHA 512 algorithm. Okay.
I didn't know whether they'd use a different mechanism. If you say, for example, you use an XX hash, and then the second time, when you do the second hash, you hash the first one with SFH.
Well, they don't do that. But the purpose for keeping this is that they keep a database of credit cards that have had fraudulent activity reported against them, along with the email address, because it's an online platform. The email address, phone number, and name of the person that presented the card. So they keep it in that kind of double hashed format, so that if it gets presented again or the email gets into a system, then they can use the same algorithm to create exactly the same string. So they can say, you know, verification, you know, that is the same card, it's been hashed in the same way. So that makes some sense, doesn't it? But then what happens if you go in with a different card using the same email address, then their systems will identify that and block that email address and block that card as well. So it was quite clever. I can't remember why we're talking about this. Oh yeah, retention.
Just retention.
Yeah, but you look at, I mean, yeah, you think about email systems, you know, data retention email systems, and the variety of personal data that's in an email system. You know, not only in emails but attachments and the directories and everything else. Well, how are you meant to try and pseudonymize and then erase that?
Just eat a lot. It's a communication tool, not a retention store. Not a document store. So delete the lot. It's only a communication tool. If it's important, well, you should be saving it elsewhere.
No, I absolutely agree with that. And I absolutely,
just like that one,
agree with
I've
that.
Got to go.
I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, when I'm in my, got my efficient head on, then I will move stuff from the email system into the CRM system or into the SharePoint. And then if it's an attachment, and then erase it. But, you know, you need the whole organization doing that. You need to allow people time to do that, which I think is a real issue.
A bit of program of work, yeah. Very good. Maybe one we need to bring back into the new year.
Well, I think someone unless somebody's got any magic wand. What I want for Christmas is a magic wand to solve data retention. You know, unless somebody's got a magic wand, I think it's going to be with us for some time.
Sure.
As a challenge. I'm just looking at the chat, Dave, here, see what what's being said. Everyone's liking your hat.
Yeah, Mark's returning a box of mince pies.
Yeah, Gary spent a lot on mince pies.
His retention is about 3 days, I think. After that, you've just got the box. You haven't got the mince pies left.
Yeah. Yes, like my memory retention. Right, I think we've probably run out of things to say. Although I've got a list, I've got a couple of pages here of stuff I was going to talk about. But
yeah, no, I've got bits and pieces. We're kind of coming upon to the end of time, and if we're not careful, we'll fall into the fun and frolics of Christmas by suggesting, did you hear what happened to the guy who sold an advent calendar? He got 25 days. Bum bum.
No, you don't. You get 24 days of an advent calendar.
But still, Christmas is here. We can't avoid it.
No. Right. Well, I'm going to get my hat off. No, I'm going to keep my hat on, actually. I'm going to get my posh rags on, and I'm going to get in the car and drive down to Leeds. And I will see you at about 2:30 for our Christmas party.
You will do. I'm going to sign off and jump in the car on the way to Leeds. But thank you to everybody who joined us this year. Thanks to everybody who listens in on the podcast series. Please do keep doing so. We're only here because you guys keep listening to us and keep suggesting ideas for us to talk about. So thank you very much. Wishing you all a very Merry Christmas. All the best for the new year. And we'll look forward to catching up with you in the early days of 2023.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Have a good night, everyone.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.